Hello, everybody. Computing the universe. I'll start by telling you a few things about computing, and then I'll take on the universe. And I'll even tell you a few things about life. History of computation. Listen, you are Chinese and I am Greek. So when I say history, I'll go way back. Because computation was extremely important in all civilizations. Of all ancient civilizations, of all civilizations that inhabited the Earth, ours is the first one that is self-conscious about the importance of computation. Okay? All the others missed it, okay, in some sense. So, because you need computation in order to partition the land, to do taxation, to do navigation, and so on. So, but the catch with computation in ancient civilizations was the system with which they represented numbers, which was not conducive to doing computation. Actually, it turns out that the ancient Chinese system was still not positional, but it had a lot of advantages over the Western systems, the Greek and the Roman. And the positional system, of course, arrived in Baghdad in the 10th century AD, and about the same time in China. The man who is credited with this is Al-Khwarizmi, who codified what we call today algorithms, to honor him. The ways we use to we learn in school to add numbers, multiply numbers, and so on. Incidentally, Al-Khwarizmi was born in Uzbekistan. Wrote in Persian and lived in Baghdad, so he's national hero in three countries. This particular picture is from Uzbekistan, and what I learned in the internet is that the local school children want to touch his turban for good luck at exams, mathematical exams. So, after Al-Khwarizmi did all this work, it took another great mathematician, the Italian Fibonacci, who lived in Pisa, to propagandize the positional system in Europe. Of course, it was one of the great democratic revolutions. And together with printing, with typography, completely changed the Europe. Of course, you know what happened next. The Renaissance happened. The Industrial Revolution happened. People created machines about everything. And the smartest of all these people, they thought that maybe it's time to create machines for doing computation. But this took its time. And it was another mathematician, this man, Alan Turing, who in 1936, when he was roughly your age, he was 23 when he came up with this idea, came up with a mathematical idea that was essentially a blueprint for computation. The paper he wrote in 1936 is considered the founding act of computer science. And Alan Turing started modern computation, and in some sense he started it on the right foot, because not only did he define a model, a mathematical model of what a computer needs to do, but he also created a universal computer. And universality is extremely important. Universality, as you know, means software, okay? We are gathered here in this event by Microsoft, okay? And software we owe to this idea of universality of Turing. And it's not clear at all why Turing chose to describe to us this universal machine. But my personal suspicion is that he wanted a very difficult programming exercise. And as many of you know, a lot of programmers come of age by writing a compiler. And that's exactly what he did. He wrote the first compiler, the first interpreter. Universality is of course of paramount importance because von Neumann later got inspired by this idea to come up with the von Neumann architecture. But one thing I want you to remember is that Turing not only defined computation, but he also taught us about computing the universe, because besides that, he also did great work in many, many fields, including artificial intelligence, of course, computer architecture and software, but also computational chemistry, biology, and so on. So, but let's go to the next act, which happened 10 years later. Another great mathematician, John von Neumann, influenced, I believe, by Turing's formalism, came up with this ingenious idea of the von Neumann architecture, which defines computers to this day. Of course, since then, a lot has happened. And we've come really a long way. When I was starting my studies in computers, in computer science, only the top two problems were around, okay? So, you know, it was extremely hard to write compilers. It was extremely hard to write operating systems. 10 years later, these problems had already been essentially solved. But new problems came up. We found out how to design databases, how to design chips, graphics, intelligent systems, slick interfaces. The point is that if you ask what's the secret, I mean, so our discipline, computer science, has conquered many extremely demanding problems, okay? Problems that required intellect, engineering ingenuity, and in all of these times came up on top. If you ask what is the engine behind this progress, you identify many factors, but of course two stand out. One is Moore's law, and the other is clever algorithms. So the point is that despite all this amazing progress, in some sense, the deepest problem of all is still unsolved. And that's the P versus NP problem, whether P is equal to NP. What I call the mystery of intractability. Is exhaustive search ever necessary? Okay, are there truly intractable problems? And it's one of these fantastic, beautiful, deep questions of pan-human interest, extremely fundamental questions, that we need no particular practical application to be deeply interested in them. I mean, how did life originate? Is there a single equation that governs the universe? How does the brain create the mind? Is exhaustive search ever necessary? I mean, if we live another 3,000 years on this planet and we don't solve these questions, what's the point? Okay, that's what I mean by questions of pan-human interest. So, and the P versus NP problem is one of these questions. Okay. I know that not all of you know about intractable problems. So let me give you one example. Imagine that you have a huge social network joining about many millions of people, and you ask the following simple question. Can you find among these 100 million people, 100 people who are all connected, are all friends to each other, okay? Of course, we don't know how to answer questions like that at all. Another, of course, important question is finding the factors of a whole number. So if I give you, if I do these computations and then I hide for you how I got 21 and ask you, what are the factors of 21? You can do that. It's 7 times 3. But what if I hide this, all right? I mean, how do you can you factor this? This one is less than 100 bits, so I can do it in a couple of hours. It is an incredibly hard problem. And in fact, more modern cryptography is based on the assumption that this problem is intractable, okay, cannot be solved in less than astronomical time. All right. P versus NP, incredibly deep problem. Some of the greater mathematical minds of the world are working on it, and they have not yet solved it. But still waiting for the proof. We have not been sitting idle. And there is this concept of NP completeness. Problems like click, but not factoring, certainly click, can be proved to be intractable. In other words, they can only be solved if P is not equal to NP. And this is a very useful way of classifying problems, but also it has acted as a great, if you wish, ambassador for our science, because it is the greatest intellectual export of computer science. Because you see, disciplines, scientific disciplines, are in the import-export business, okay? And the more ideas, the more people listen to your ideas, the more prestige the science has, okay? And I believe that that NP completeness is one of these singular achievements that have shown in all disciplines. Many, many years ago, I looked at how many papers in physics and chemistry use NP complete in their abstract and title, and there were many, many thousands of them. Okay, I don't remember the exact number, but 20 years ago, there were probably 5,000 or 6,000 papers that use this term in their title and abstract. So it is a concept that has radiated from computer science to all other sciences. All right. So what have I told you so far? Computer science has conquered some deep and important, practically important technological problems. Its core contains some very fundamental problems, like P versus NP, the kind of problems that give a particular discipline prestige. What else? So from now on, I'm going to point to the main argument of my talk, and that is that computer science can act also as a lens for the sciences. And here's what I mean by that. That by this I mean the following, that over these past 70 years, and in order to conquer the problems that I have been mentioning, compilers, chips, learning machines, computer scientists developed a particular very different and very novel way of thinking, what sometimes we call computational thinking or often algorithmic thinking. And it turns out that when people who have been trained in this thinking turn around and think about a problem in other science, then sometimes serendipitous progress happens. And the reason, there is a reason for that. The reason is that everywhere in the objects of science, and certainly everywhere in the model that scientists over the centuries have developed for these objects, for these scientific objects, there are computational processes. There is latent computation, if you wish. And that's why this algorithmic computational way of thinking is particularly apt for attacking problems that you wouldn't have expected. And I'm going to give you a few examples. And let's start with physics, in some sense the most prestigious of all natural sciences. What I'm going to argue is that this algorithmic way of thinking affects, but also tests, and that's actually a very, very important point, some of the most prestigious theories about the universe. And let's start with statistical physics. One of the deepest problems that had been solved for a very long time, one of the deepest mysteries in physics, is this: how do lakes freeze? How does the lake freeze? By this I mean the following: that there are huge systems of small particles that have quite simple local interactions. And these simple local interactions, when a particular global parameter changes, temperature in this case, they have a very global effect, okay? There is a sudden, abrupt global change. And a lot of wise people in physics have been trying to explain this over the centuries, and statistical physics is the discipline that studies this phenomena. And it turns out that this mystery, the mystery of phase transitions, as it's called, is essentially coterminal, tantamount, equivalent to another mystery in algorithms. Why some algorithms, some randomized algorithms called Markov chain, Monte Carlo, why do they speed up suddenly when some parameters change? Why they converge faster than before? And this was a really amazing convergence between two disciplines, statistical physics and computer science and the study of algorithms, because you have the phenomenon that a lot of computer scientists made seminal contribution into statistical physics, and many physicists turned to be algorithm designers, and they have come with algorithms that turned out to be actually practically useful. So there is a convergence between two disciplines, which is an amazing phenomenon in the few times that it happens. All right. So that's about statistical physics. Let's talk about something even heavier, quantum computation. And quantum computation, many of you must have heard of it, is about reinventing the bit, okay? And the bit, as you know, is one of the most fundamental ideas in computer science. It basically it says that if with binary values you can encode information very efficiently, you can also implement it by, let's say, electronics, that a wire can have either too many electrons or few electrons, and that defines a bit. But then in quantum mechanics, there is something that we call qubit. And for example, it may mean that an electron is either close to the nucleus or far from the nucleus. Okay, that's another bit, except it's a qubit, it's not a bit. And there is a huge difference. But a bit is either zero or one. Okay, and in fact, the technological promise that a bit will be either zero or one underlies much of chip design. And a qubit, in contrast, is in both states. And it's in quantum mechanics, it is denoted like that, where the alpha and the beta, so it's both in the zero, that's sort of the funny boxed in zero, or one, boxed in one, but zero is multiplied by alpha and one is multiplied by beta, and these alpha and betas are numbers, okay? Every time I call them probabilities, I lose friends in the physics department because they are not probabilities, they are something else. They are complex numbers, for instance, but they are something like probabilities. And if that's not bad enough, that a particular atom of hydrogen can be two states at the same time, if you take 1,000 atoms of hydrogen, they can be in 2 to the 1,000 states at the same time. By this I mean that if you take, remember, 1,000 atoms of hydrogen is an unimaginably small quantity of mass. But, and of course, 2 to the 1,000 in an unimaginably huge quantity of information. So you have this seeming contradiction, conundrum in quantum mechanics. How can nature be so extravagant in representing itself? And actually, there is this great physicist, Richard Feynman, who in 1982 asked precisely this question. How do you simulate such a system on a computer? Okay, it's, you know, if you need exponentially many numbers to express a particular system, how do you simulate, how do you track its evolution on a computer? And very brilliantly, Feynman turned this question on its head, turned it around, and asked something that now seems obvious. Yes, but imagine that we build a machine out of things. What could that machine now compute, okay? And presumably, it probably will have to be more powerful than other computers, okay? And the only question was, can there be something like Turing's theory that tells us that, yes, such machines, at least in theory, can be built? And this happened about 10 years after Feynman. And yes, it was shown that it can be done, all right, and in theory. And then, a few years later, Peter Shor, a mathematician at MIT, showed that if this happens, if we are able to build computers like Feynman envisioned, then your credit card number is not safe on the internet, okay? Because factoring can be done easily, and therefore modern cryptography is in shambles. All right. So I love this quote by Umesh Vazirani, that quantum computation is not so much about creating great new machines, very powerful machines. It is more about testing the validity of quantum physics. Okay, so this is, if you think about it, it's a momentous statement. I mean, it says that the most prestigious theory about the universe is being tested, is being tried on algorithmic ideas. Okay. All right, so this is the world's worst animation, all right? I mean, also, but I am the world's worst animator, okay? But I want to tell you this story, that in the beginning there were computers, and there were more and more of them, and then some very clever men decided that it's a good idea to put a little cloud in the middle and so that these computers can talk to each other. And then guess what? A funny thing happened. This cloud grew and grew until there was nothing else. Okay, so by this I mean that the internet has eclipsed the computer. Computer science is no longer the science that studies the computer. Okay, that was the first 40 years, perhaps, of computer science. Now computer science studies the global information environment that was created by the internet. And that's an amazing transformation. Computer happened to be the gadget that brought us the internet, okay? Now the internet is here. So this is, I guess, a word of caution to the computer scientist students in the audience, that, you know, the last 20 years, our science has changed tremendously. For example, the internet has made computer science a social science. Why is the internet here? The internet is here not because somebody designed it. The internet is here because we all wanted it to be here, okay? Here's another famous quote by my colleague Scott Schenker. According to Scott, the internet is in equilibrium. All we have to do is identify the game. Okay, so this brings me to the core of the claim that computer science is now a social science, okay? Because equilibria are a very important concept in economics, okay? It's probably the central concept in economics. You see on the left here an equilibrium. It is an equilibrium. Here is why it's an equilibrium. Incidentally, the picture on the right is an equilibrium. Equilibrium gives you an image of serenity and peace. Not necessarily. As long as people keep doing the same thing, using the same strategy, that's an equilibrium. The image on the left is an equilibrium because, you see, the mango would love to be at the bottom of the bowl. But as long as nothing else moves, it will stay where it is. Equilibrium means that everybody does as well as it can, as he can, given what everybody else is doing. Okay? If nobody else changes, I'm not going to change. That's what an equilibrium is. Now, equilibria has a quite long history in economics. The first to observe that equilibrium exists in games, in social processes, is the same ingenious mathematician who, 18 years later, built the first computer. He pointed out that two-person zero games have them, all right? And it waited for, you know, we had to wait for a long time, a quarter century, for John Nash, famous from the movie that I show here, A Beautiful Mind. John Nash showed that all games have Nash equilibria. And this was a momentous result for economics because, in some sense, liberated the minds of economists. The Nash equilibrium became the central concept in economics. Roger Myerson, another ingenious economist who got the Nobel Prize a few years back, wrote in 1999 that equilibria lie the foundations of modern economic thought. The reason is that what economists do is design institutions. And in the design of institutions, the question the economists usually ask is, what would the Nash equilibrium be here, okay? And therefore, this result by Nash, who showed that all games have equilibria, gave them a free hand to go out and design institutions and markets and auctions. Disaster struck. Computer scientists prove, actually, one was our group at Berkeley, and the other was a group of researchers in China. We proved that finding equilibria is an intractable problem. It's one of these problems that take astronomical time to compute. And if you think about it, it means that equilibria cannot be a useful prediction of the way in which a group of people are going to behave. In the immortal words of Kamal Jain, who is the chief scientist of eBay today, if your laptop can't find it, neither can the market. Okay? So this means that the Nash equilibrium and the other concepts of equilibrium are not as safe bets, as useful predictions, as we thought that they were. Okay, so this is my last subject. I'm going to tell you a few things about evolution. This is a problem that I've been working on for the last 7-8 years. I believe it's the world's and science's most interesting problem. There are two reasons for this, okay? One is that nothing in life makes sense except in the light of evolution. Okay, this is Theodosius Dobzhansky said that. And the other reason why it's a very challenging problem is another quote by Jacques Monod. These are, by the way, two of the greatest biologists of the last century. Jacques Monod said, that the strange thing about evolution is that everybody believes that he understands it. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about evolution. First of all, we know how evolution started. This is Charles Darwin. In 1959, wrote this incredible book called On the Origin of Species. I totally wish that all of you read it, okay? It is an amazing book. It is a great book, not only because of the subject, and not only because he got everything right, because he didn't, but it's a great example of scientific propaganda, of scientific, you know, at Berkeley, they teach this book in the Department of Rhetoric, because it is an amazing specimen of scientific rhetoric, okay? So it is really a great, great reading. Incidentally, Darwin's contribution was not to come up with the idea of evolution. This was well known by this time. Darwin's contribution was to come up with two important ideas: common ancestry, that we all come from one species, ancestral species, and natural selection, which is the force behind evolution, the moving force of evolution. So let me tell you briefly what happened since 59. All right. So soon after that, a monk called Gregor Mendel came up with the laws of genetics that we all know today. Unfortunately, his work remained a secret for 35 years, even though it was properly published. When it became known, it brought a crisis in evolutionary thinking, because people thought that it was conflicted with Darwin's. Because, you see, Darwin, it was implicit in Darwin's work that all these characteristics of interest that in various animals and plants that have evolved, that all these characteristics were continuous. And Mendel showed us that characteristics are discrete. And of course, this looked like a major conflict. And a very interesting thing that happened 30 years later is that this conflict was resolved by the development of a mathematical theory, what is now called population genetics, which characterizes evolution. It's a mathematical theory that models in a powerful and convincing way the process of evolution. And of course, since 1980, the field of evolution has been suffering the deluge has been inundated by molecular data, which it is actually trying to explain. It's an amazing theory. It's a powerful, brilliant theory, but the most important questions are left unanswered. So I cannot insist how much brilliant work remains to be done here. First of all, how do complex adaptations, complex changes, you know, how does the eye evolve, okay? How did the eye evolve? Darwin himself admitted that when people ask him about the eye, do you really believe that it was a random mutation that brought the eye, that this gives him the chills? But forget the eye. You know what is the most amazing organ of the human body? It is the placenta, okay? It developed 65 million ago, out of the confluence, the collaboration of 1,500 genes, okay? So imagine, 1,500 genes, a big part, almost 10% of all our genes, 5-10% of all our genes, participating in this amazing organ. Without it, we would all be kangaroos now. How do things like that happen, okay? I mean, how do such complex new changes happen in life? Even more mysterious, believe it or not, the greatest mystery in evolution today is, why do we all have a mom and a dad, okay? if you look at it from the elements of, you know, from the elementary facts about evolution, it makes no sense because it has a lot of disadvantages for the individual, for the species, and yet it's ubiquitous. There are no plants, no animals, not even prokaryotes, not even bacteria that do not exchange genes. And also, the third one is, why so much genetic diversity? I mean, if your DNA and my DNA differ in about 3% of the positions, the theory predicts less than 1%, 0.1%. Why? Why this big gap? All right. So let me tell you about the second question, which is, what is the role of sex? I have, you know, we have done some, I believe, interesting work. So here is a radical idea. We wrote a paper about it about 7 years ago in our group at Berkeley. What if evolution under sex is a poor optimizer of fitness? Fitness, of course, is what makes particular organisms strong. In population genetics, fitness is the expected number of children that this particular organism is going to have. So, what if? And of course, fitness depends on everything, all right? I mean, it's the most holistic characteristic that we have, because it depends on how good our liver is, how good our skin is, and so on and so forth, how clever we are, and all this. So, and the reason why I was interested in this was computational, was algorithmic, that when you do recombination, in other words, when you simulate evolution under sex, in algorithms, in heuristics, you don't get as good results as you get when you don't do recombination. And so we got to think this. I mean, what if, in fact, sex is not a good optimizer of fitness? But what if it's done something else? And what if this something else is its reason of existence? And it turns out that we found it. I mean, it's something that we call mixability. And it turns out that evolution under sex favors alleles. What's an allele? This strange word means the following: that the genes in your body, in your cells, come in many variants, okay? And in particular, you have two of these variants, okay? But all of us together, we have many, many more for every gene. And these alleles, so these variants are called alleles in biology. So these alleles, which alleles eventually survive and become ubiquitous? Those, not those that create interesting, lucky combinations, but those that are good mixers, that collaborate well with other alleles, with a broad spectrum of other alleles, of genetic partners. And so this is something that we showed by simulations. It's something that we showed later by mathematics. And there is a surprising connection with game theory, my previous subject. And so, before I explain it to you, there is one way. Okay, take a walk in the park and look around you, and to everybody, this amazing wonderment comes. How all this diversity of life, all this miracle of life around us, how could it evolve by this crude mechanism, by this natural selection thing, over just 3 billion years, over 1 trillion generations, okay? It's amazing. Since the beginning of life, there has been only 1 trillion generations. 1 trillion may sound like a huge number, but it's not, okay? Your cell phones executed a trillion operations since the beginning of my talk, okay? And they haven't accomplished much, all right? So a trillion is small. How is it that all of life was created essentially in a trillion steps? And it turns out that there is a very interesting connection with game theory. If you look the right way at the complicated equations of population genetics that were developed about 100 years ago and has been used ever since for explaining evolution, if you look at them the right way, you notice that they are tantamount, they're exactly the same as a repeated game between genes. In other words, you can think of evolution as a game between genes. What are the strategies? So in games, every player has a strategy. The strategy of every gene is its alleles. Okay? So, next, when I say the strategy are the alleles, I mean that the frequency of the alleles are the probabilities with which every gene has this, plays this strategy. So, evolution is the evolution of population is a gene sitting around and minding their investment in alleles. Okay? That's what it says. And the common utility, what all these genes care to optimize, is the fitness. Okay? They want the expected fitness of the population to be as large as possible. Amazingly, because, I mean, when you look at the miracle of life, what comes to you is, what algorithm could have created all this is just 1 trillion steps, okay? And the amazing thing is that we have found the algorithm, that the game is played through multiplicative updates. Multiplicative updates, okay? So multiplicative updates is a simple common sense algorithm that has been rediscovered many times. In fact, AI researchers have rediscovered it twice. And is well known in CS for its power to solve sophisticated problems, problems that it didn't have the right to expect to solve. And another very interesting mathematical fact about this algorithm, which again seems to lie at the core, at the inner loop of evolution, is that what it seeks to optimize is a trade-off between two quantities. One is fitness, and the other is genetic diversity. Okay? So, in many ways, in evolution under sex, our genes play this game having two goals in the back of their head. One is maximizing fitness, and the other is caring a little about diversity as well. All right. So, in conclusion, because my time is slowly ending, a computation is just the key idea, not just the key idea behind the computational revolution and the internet that we have seen. It's a little bit more. Itself, it's full of deep foundational questions of great interest, of pan-human interest. And it's also a lens, a productive point of view for understanding some deep questions in science. And I gave you a few examples, but there are many more, and many, many more to be discovered by you. Quantum mechanics, statistical physics, economics and game theory, and evolution. Okay? Thank you very much.